From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
It's a very exciting day in our campaign. Today we announce our selection, my new partner as Lieutenant Governor candidate for the state of Illinois.
So, I'm not sure what you folks in the press were expecting, but I'm sure that a 4'11" Latina with an Italian last name and three small children is certainly not what the career politicians out in Springfield expected. However, as Bruce has always maintained, el cambio está en camino. Change is on its way.
You know, this is not rocket science. Springfield is not some complex thing where you need an advanced engineering degree to understand. This is about creative problem solving. This is about tough negotiations. This is the same process we do in business every day. And we'll have allies to help us navigate the subtleties with Springfield. It ain't that hard.
That is Republican gubernatorial candidate Bruce Rauner and Evelyn Sanguinetti of Wheaton, who will be his running mate for lieutenant governor. That shores up the running mate situations, I think, on the Republican side of things. Meanwhile, Pat Quinn yet to announce who his partner will be on the ballot. That, and using a central Illinois congressman's stance on Obamacare, has turned into an early campaign ad campaign. We'll discuss those issues and more on State Week. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield and a longtime reporter at the Illinois State House, Sean Crawford, WUIS News Director, Brian Mackey, State House reporter for WUIS and IPR, and our guest this week from Illinois Issues Magazine, Jamie Dunn. Jamie, thanks for coming out and being on the show today.
Happy to be here, Bill.
Well, folks, it's hard to get ultra excited about lieutenant governor announcements.
It's a slow news week.
But we'll start and just update us a little on Bruce Rauner and his new running mate.
Yeah, so her name is Evelyn Sanguinetti, or as she said in a Spanish language YouTube video that was online, Evelyn Sanguinetti. And she studied piano performance in college and went on to become a lawyer. She worked for former Republican Attorney General Jim Ryan. And 2 years ago, she was elected to the Wheaton City Council. And now she is on the ballot running with Bruce Rauner to be, you know, his lieutenant governor candidate. A pretty big electoral leap, but something that's not really out of character with his campaign, which is he's running as the ultimate outsider, trying to oppose what he calls the entrenched politicians in Springfield. And so I don't think it's a big surprise that he did not choose somebody from within that circle.
And he used the phrase, it ain't that hard to do that down there, although he's probably never had to put on copper doors on a state house. Charlie Wheeler, you weren't too fond of his comments.
Well, I guess to be uncharitable, it sounds like he's pretty arrogant. And the fact of the matter is, if you're the head of a company or you're moving in the circles in which he moves, you're used to telling flunkies to jump and they say, yes, sir, how high? State government doesn't work that way. You have to deal with a lot of people, and it's going to be different if he's elected governor and has to deal with a Mike Madigan and a John Cullerton. You don't tell Madigan and Cullerton to jump and expect them to tell you anything other than where you can stick it. And if you don't have the familiarity with the issues, and he appears not to, at least he doesn't want to say where he stands on most issues, and his standard response is, well, I really haven't studied that yet. And if you're not able to get along with the people, you're just not ready for it. And again, to me, it sounds pretty arrogant to say it ain't rocket science. And in a sense, it's more difficult than rocket science because most science practice on the practical level, there are certain rules and certain laws of physics and so on that if you follow those rules and laws, it'll be a predictable outcome. On the other hand, state government is about relationships. It's about personalities. It's about issues. It's about, when the day is done, being able to get 60 votes in the House and 30 votes in the Senate. And if you come in with the attitude that I'll make these legislative leaders and these entrenched politicians bow to my will, you're getting off on a horrible bad foot. It reminds me kind of the problems that Dan Walker had when he tried to come in as an outsider and shake things up. And we all know how well that worked out for him.
You know, it strikes me that it's also not that different than the message that Governor Quinn has been putting out there. I mean, he is still he spent his entire career before becoming lieutenant governor and then governor as an outsider, throwing stones at the establishment. And now he is still trying to portray himself as the outsider. So it'll be interesting to see how Mr. Rauner attempts to differentiate himself from the sitting governor, who I don't think you can say he has not really tried to beat up on the legislature. That is not a charge you can throw at Pat Quinn.
Now, I have noticed this is the first year where the candidates actually pick their running mate. So there is sometimes a little bit of strategy involved, or I guess one would hope the candidates have strategy involved. Sean Crawford picking a Latina candidate. They're going to emphasize that a lot. Is that something that will be smart in the electoral politics this year?
Well, it doesn't hurt them. And I mean, don't forget that the Democratic Party, there really are no primaries on the statewide ticket this year. So what you're going to see possibly is more emphasis and more focus during the primary season on the Republican side. Maybe that will drag some people out to vote that might otherwise have voted Democratic, might even vote Democratic in the general election, but might take a Republican ballot in the spring. So it doesn't hurt him, I don't think, in any way. Nobody's really going to vote for any of these candidates, I think, usually based on who their running mate is, unless it might be a very hyper-local type of thing. You know, Jill Tracy is Kirk Dillard's running mate. It might help Dillard a little bit in parts of western Illinois, you know, because that's where she's from. Who knows? But, I mean, really, it's not – I don't think this is going to have a big play one way or the other for any of these candidates.
I think you're right, Sean. It's not necessarily something that it's a positive, although I think we have seen that it can be a negative. So,
right. So like
Sarah Palin, I think that – proved to be a big drag on the McCain campaign in 2008 because people wondered, is this person really ready if something happens to John McCain? And I think that that's a question that we're going to be asking all the lieutenant governor candidates, and especially, including Evelyn Sanguinetti. You know, what is a Wheaton city councilwoman who's been in office for 2 years ready to take over the fifth most populous state in the country if something were to happen?
She does have an interesting and maybe kind of atypical profile for a Republican lieutenant governor candidate. Both of her parents are immigrants. She was on public aid as a child. She talked about that a little bit in her introductory YouTube video. So she brings some interesting, you know, background to the job that will at least maybe garner some press attention just because it's human interesty.
Yeah, no. I think it was interesting in that YouTube video. They made a point of saying that her mother legally immigrated. So just kind of, you know, yet again hitting that button with the electoral base there.
Now, when is Governor Quinn going to announce his running mate? And is anybody sitting there anxiously waiting?
It doesn't seem like they're in a rush. I mean, before Daley dropped out, they had said kind of off the record, oh, in a couple weeks. And now I don't. You know, we don't really have a timeline. So.
I mean, it's an interesting – because I think the thought was before he might have needed somebody to help him in the primary, right? So if he was going to be running against Bill Daley, he might have chosen an African-American person to turn out – you know, try and gin up the vote in the African-American community. But now he can maybe look ahead to the general election because he doesn't have a primary opponent and maybe pick somebody downstate. I'm not sure.
When will they be filing their petitions? When will they have to tell us that they're running and have a running mate?
I believe the deadline is the first week in December.
Yeah, that's right. And from my understanding is that you have to list the lieutenant governor candidate even when you're circulating the petition.
Right,
so it can't be too much
both
longer.
Both names have to be on the petition. On the other hand, if Quinn has anywhere halfway decent political organization, he should be able to get the petition signed within a week.
I think there's only, 5,000 or something like that?
Yeah, it's a pretty low number.
And moving on from that, Congressman Rodney Davis, he represents a swath of central Illinois. He is a Republican, first-term congressman from Taylorville. He's already facing a Republican challenge from a former Miss America, Erica Harold. Now he is coming under some fire because of what's going on in Washington or not going on, but it all pertains to his stance on the health care law, known as Obamacare to many. And that's turned into an early ad campaign against him. Update us on that.
Yeah, I think what's fascinating, what first called my attention to this is there was an article actually on the New Yorker's website by their great political writer Ryan Lizza, where he talked about where the GOP's quote-unquote suicide caucus lives. That's a name that a Republican had given to this group of mostly Tea Party affiliated Republicans in the U.S. Congress who have, you know, pushed to shut down the government over defunding the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. And it's surprised the heck out of me that there was a little red dot over Springfield, and it was Congressman Davis's district. It was one of these people who had signed a letter a couple of months ago to House Speaker John Boehner urging this course of action. And, you know, the general thought in Washington has been, well, all these Republicans, they're from such safe districts, right? These people who are pushing this shutdown, they don't have to worry about an electoral backlash. But Congressman Davis comes from one of the least safe districts in the United States House. He won his last election by, I think, 0.3 percentage points of the vote. So it was just it's kind of been a surprising turn. And yeah, we've seen both sides making a lot of political hay out of it.
And Davis has a bigger problem too, I think, and that is that he has to spend time fighting off a primary challenge from Erica Herold, as you mentioned. In some ways, he has to, you know, get his base in order. So right there, I think he would prefer not to have to do that and be able to focus on the general election, but he really can't look past the primary. That could be a problem for him as well. So yeah, he's got it coming from all sides at him right now.
And he's kind of constantly reminding people when he gives speeches, he brings that up. I'm the number one, you know, target for Democrats, the number one congressional target. So it's something that clearly is ever present in his mindset. And like Sean said, I think it's sort of, trying to move to the base in that primary, but then what is he going to do when we get to the general?
And this district is a rather interesting district for those that are in other parts of the state and don't know where it is. You know, it goes all the way into the Metro East area near St. Louis, in some very traditional Democratic areas there. Then it cuts across Springfield and into, you know, Decatur and all the way into Champaign, up parts of Bloomington and in those areas, oftentimes again very Democratic. So again, it's one of the tightest. I think will be one of the tightest elections for this seat coming up. There's already, I think, three or four people wanting to run for it on the Democratic side as well. So it's everybody in the pool right now with this election.
Well, it's interesting because when the Democrats drew the congressional map, this was kind of a throwaway district, and they figured that Tim Johnson, the incumbent congressman, Republican, was going to run again, and so they didn't try and craft a district that could elect a Democrat, and they kind of left it in the middle. And had Johnson been on the ticket, he would have won handily last time out. But Johnson decided not to seek re-election for personal reasons, he said, family reasons. And so Davis became the anointed choice of the Republican committeeman in the district. And so he found himself in a tough contest against Dr. David Gill, who had lost, I believe, two or three times to Johnson previously. And I suspect that had the Democratic map makers known of Johnson's intentions to resign the nomination after the primary, the district would have been drawn differently, and it would be a district that would be leaning Democratic.
And there was also a third party candidate last time around who drew, I think, 7% of the vote.
Yeah.
And so that I haven't heard anything about that happening this time, and it's not clear to me which way that necessarily would have cut last time around. But from, you know, I watched one of the debates and he sounded, I would say, more on the Democratic side than the Republican side. So conceivably, if they were really informed voters, they might have been, you know, going with him instead of Gill.
This is State Week. The trains will keep rolling. We'll tell you about that in just a minute.
Support for State Week in Review comes from the Illinois State Bar Association, whose activities include proposing and shaping legislation, educating the public, and supporting the courts and the rule of law. Information at IllinoisLawyerFinder.com.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Sean Crawford, Brian Mackey, and Illinois Issues Magazine's Jamie Dunn. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Brian Mackey, there was a deal, and probably most people weren't even aware this threat was existing out there, but The state of Illinois and Amtrak have reached a deal for the state of Illinois to cover more cost of providing rail service within the state.
That's right. So this all goes back to 2008. Congress passed a law where they wanted states to help pick up more of the cost of these short-distance rail lines. These go 750 miles or less. There were 19 states that were affected, and as typically happens in government and journalism and probably, you know, college papers and all kinds of things, people waited until the last minute, and the deadline was supposed to be October 1st of this year. Well, a lot of places blew through that, but Illinois was one of, you know, other states, as they've gotten in line on this, they've worked out their deals. Illinois was one of the last states to come on board. Right now, as we're taping this on Friday, Indiana is the only one that has not yet signed its agreement or finalized its agreement with the federal government to pay for the Chicago to Indianapolis Hoosier line. But so in Illinois, the state is already paying the cost of Chicago to Wisconsin, Quincy and Carbondale, and it pays a lot of the cost for the Springfield line. Now it's going to be picking up the entire cost of the Springfield line. The threat here is that if the Illinois had not stepped up next week, or I should say this coming week, the trains might have shut down. Amtrak was threatening to just stop rail service on these lines. It had warned its employees that they might be laid off. So this averts that happening.
It averts a shutdown from a government-funded rail service.
Right. Well, you know, and this actually doesn't really have anything to do with it. I mean, it's confusing because the timeline is the same, but this is separate from the federal government shutdown.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be all the trains, right? The trains that start from Chicago, go through Springfield and go down to Texas or go to the West Coast would have still continued. It would be the local runs that the state –
I think it's called the Lincoln service that goes from Chicago to St. Louis and back. Yeah, one like the Texas Eagle that comes through Springfield and used to wake me up all the time when I lived downtown. those trains would not be affected by this, although there is talk in Washington about maybe I think there are a lot of fiscal conservatives in the federal government who would like to see Amtrak take even less federal money in the future. So that could be coming down the line.
The state plays a big role in funding Amtrak routes from Chicago to Quincy, down through Springfield to St. Louis, all the way to Carbondale and beyond. Am I missing?
Well, there's also a Chicago to somewhere in Wisconsin. I'm not sure where it ends.
Milwaukee route.
We share that cost with Wisconsin.
Yeah. All right. Immigrant driver's licenses are beginning to roll out in Illinois. Jamie Dunn, can you tell us what's up with that?
Yeah. So folks who are in the country without documentation can now get driver's licenses. Well, not right now, but can get driver's license in Illinois thanks to a new law that was passed. And starting in December, Secretary of State's office is going to start having appointments with people who are interested in getting those licenses. You have to provide some information. You have to prove that you've been in the state for a year, because they don't want folks coming in from other states that don't offer this to get a license. You have to show that you have the proper liability insurance, at least, for your vehicle, and it's a $30 fee. But starting in December, people who are interested in this can call up their local Secretary of State's office, DMV, and make an appointment to come in and go through that process and get a license. The licenses are just a 3-year temporary license. You can't use them to vote. You can't use them to get on a plane. They look different than the typical driver's license. They're, I believe, a blue background instead of a red background. So so you can, you know, tell the difference so that you can use them for flight or something like that. But anyway, that's, you know, starting to take off. It's one of the biggest undertakings the Secretary of State's office has done in many years. So we'll kind of be keeping tabs on how that's going.
Well, they'd be similar to the licenses that are now available to people who are diplomats or foreign students, exchange students who are here.
Mm-hmm. Do we know if there's going to be a big demand, though, for these? I know that there had been some talk before when this was being debated that, you know, a lot of these folks who are here illegally in the U.S. Don't want to go to the government and say, hey, I'm here and I don't have all the documentation maybe that I need. I need a driver's license. But they don't want to reach out to the government in that way. Is there any thought on what the demand will be?
Yeah, I think, you know, that concern is always going to be present. The estimate is that there's 250,000 people driving right now without documentation, without a driver's license. I would think some of the folks, some of the, you know, dreamers, the younger folks that are getting the deferment at the federal level might be interested in doing this because they're already, you know, presenting their information for that. But yeah, there is always that concern, and I think that's going to be difficult to predict who is going to be willing to share their information with the state.
I think at the time the legislation went through, the estimates were that maybe half of the undocumented people would go ahead and do this. And the argument was made that to get one of these licenses, you have to have insurance, you have to go through the same driver's tests and the on-road tests that anyone else does. And it was portrayed as being a safety issue because these folks are out there and they're driving, they're taking their kids to school, they're going to work, and this would enhance the, I guess, the capabilities, the driving skills and the insurance coverage for people who are driving already.
And we saw the insurance companies were in favor of this because it's more customers for them and they're not going to be on the hook. Well, I guess this is a problem of some significance up in the suburbs where there are a lot more undocumented people who are illegally who are driving around, get in an accident. If they don't have insurance, then the driver who is insured is on the hook, or their insurance company is on the hook for that full amount.
And that kind of cuts both ways. We definitely heard stories when this legislation was passing of insurance companies maybe kind of fly-by-night operations insuring people who did not have a license who were here illegally, and then when they were in an accident saying, oh, well, you don't have a license, we can't help you out, and not actually covering them, collecting their premiums, but then when they had an accident, not actually covering them. So some of the hope is that it'll end some of that fraud. But the Secretary of State's office is planning for about 100,000 people. That's what they're anticipating. That's what they're setting up for in the first year. That doesn't mean that it will turn out to be that many people, but that's what they're planning for.
I think there's one more dimension about this we haven't talked about, which is the political aspect. And it was interesting to me. This kind of came up, to my mind, a little bit out of nowhere. We hadn't heard a lot about this before until the last election last year in November 2012. And then people began lining up, and there were a lot of Republicans who came out in favor of this. There was a big splashy press conference at which I think former Governor Edgar was there, Controller Judy Bart Topinka was there, Bill Brady, who is now a state senator, who is now a candidate for governor, he supported this legislation. And so it'll be interesting to see if any of the Republicans – we talked a little bit earlier about the choice of Evelyn Sanguinetti as the lieutenant governor candidate for Bruce Rauner. It'll be interesting, I think, to see if any of the Republicans campaign on this as an issue in the next year's election as an attempt to sort of soften the hardline anti-immigrant view that the party has gained in some circles.
Yeah, this is an issue that kept coming. It was one of those issues that kept coming back around, but never quite getting the support that it needed. I remember covering it when I was an intern. Governor Edgar has been a longtime supporter of this issue, but it did seem that Obama's reelection and looking at the demographics there might have been the thing that kind of pushed it over the hill and made it a pet issue for people who weren't as adamant about it previously.
And one other issue, those out there who happen to own and operate ATVs, they're going to feel a pinch from the government.
They are. This is part of that large IDNR sustainability package,
that's
they called
Department
it.
Of Natural Resources.
Department of Natural Resources was having some major budget issues. Part of the reason why is because a lot of their spending was being pushed into special funds out of the general revenue fund for years, and those funds were spent down, and they found themselves in a situation where they couldn't pay for maintenance on the parks and trails and roads. And so the legislature passed a package of funding sources for them. One of the sources was increasing the your license plate sticker by $2. There are other various fees in there, and one of those fees is just starting to be implemented. It will begin early next year. If you drive an ATV or like a dirt bike motorcycle off road, you will have to get it licensed. It's going to cost $15.50 for the license. It lasts a year. It's just a sticker that you put on your ATV. If you ride your ATV at home, just in your yard area, or if you have woods or something like that and that's where you live, you don't have to get it. But if you take it, to your friend's house or you take it anywhere off your property, you have to have this license. They're liking it to a fishing license where, if you buy a fishing pole, they don't make you buy a fishing license. But if you get caught out there fishing without the license, you're in trouble and you have to pay a fee. It's going to be kind of the same thing. If you buy an ATV, you don't have to buy this sticker. But if you are caught out riding around without it, you're going to get a ticket.
So Jamie Dunn will stay on her lawn
out of that one. Yeah. And the money... the hope is that the money can be used to match federal dollars to create some public areas where people can ride off-road vehicles, because right now the state doesn't maintain any public areas and there are problems with trespassing. People will, be taking their four-wheelers on the Farmer Bob's land and tearing things up, and that's, you know, causing damage and upsetting people. So the hope is that they can create some public lands where people can ride.
Yet another area in which I'm kind of interested to see if the recent funding improvements for the Department of Natural Resources, that's an agency that's been starved for money for so long, and now they've got the license plate fee and this and other things going on. It'll be interesting to see if they can finally start catching up with some of their long, long backlog of repairs and improvements they've wanted to do in the parks.
Yeah, and I talked to him about that when I talked to DNR on this story. And they are making slow progress. It seems like this next upcoming spring and summer is when a lot of things are going to be going on with them as far as repairing things, putting in new restrooms, those kind of things. So they said, watch the summer. You're going to see some improvement. We can't fix it all in one season, but you're going to start seeing some of the things, the conditions at the parks getting better.
And we go now for some notes from the field. We'll start with Charlie Wheeler.
Well, the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs came out with its flash index, and it shows that there was a strong increase in September going to 107.0, which was half a percent higher than last month, and it's a new post-recession high, the highest level since April of 2007, and anything above 100 is considered as economic growth. But Professor J. Fred Geertz, who compiles this index, warns that the state still has high unemployment despite the economic growth, and there's a difficulty in finding workers for some skilled jobs, and people who don't have the necessary skills are still out looking for work. Some have dropped out of the labor force, and we have the second highest unemployment rate in the nation behind Nevada.
Jamie Dunn.
Yeah, some of the revenue numbers came in for the state's video poker. You know, you may have noticed at your local restaurant or bar or truck stop that you can now play video poker and bet money instead of doing it just for fun. Supposedly it was supposed to be just for fun before it was legalized, although often people were doing betting under the table. Well, the money coming in is a lot less than what was expected. The hope was that the state could bring in $1 billion in revenue, and we're only seeing about $43, $44 million. So it's lagging behind. The implementation has been slow, and it's just not meeting the hoped expectations for how much money it's bringing in, which funds our capital program, so that's definitely a problem.
And Brian Mackey.
Just an update on – we talked last week about the tax incentive, the tax break that people are trying to push through for Archer Daniels Midland Company to keep jobs in the state of Illinois. Office Max is also another company that is looking at hoping to get a tax break. They're merging with Office Depot if the federal government approves it, and there's been kind of waiting for a CEO to get named before the state would decide – or before, I should say, before the company decides whether it will stay in Illinois. Part of that is they want a tax break here, but there's a question of whether a CEO would even take the job until the federal government approves it, and just showing that state and federal government are always intertwined in ways you might not expect. There's been no word on the process of that because the Federal Trade Commission is shut down during the federal government shutdown. So we're just kind of in a holding pattern to see whether Office Max will keep 2,000 jobs in the Chicago suburbs.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of State Week. Thanks to Jamie Dunn of Illinois Issues for joining us. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org, or if using a desktop or laptop, find it on iTunes by searching State Week in Review. Production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.